Think Again with Borderlands Cooperative.
Join us for critical conversations about things that matter.
Every Friday at 10 a.m. on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on your dial.
And 3CR Digital, streaming live at 3cr.org.au.
So together, let's think again about important matters affecting us, like economics,
politics,
education,
health,
climate,
and what we can do about it all. Welcome to Think Again, a program produced and presented by Borderlands Cooperative, an organization working for social change for over 28 years meanwhile. We're broadcasting from the 3CR studio on the not-ceded land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I'm Jacques Boulet, and whilst Jennifer has a day off today, as part of the 1st of May Labor Day 3CR day-long program, I'm having an hour-long conversation with Stefan Gigac and Jorge Jorquera about the three of our experiences in and with a workers' movement that emerged within the Catholic Church. So welcome to the program, Stefan and Jorge.
Thanks very much, Jacques. Great to be with you on this special day.
Likewise. Good morning, Jacques.
Good morning to both. The Melbourne May Day Committee intends to remind people of the history of May Day. May, the first, as the International Workers' Day, celebrated throughout the world, and I'm quoting the committee's text, since 1890 as a day to demonstrate demands for a better way of life, for decent pay, improved working and living conditions, protecting our planet and environment, and for opposition to imperial wars, and for a society that meets the needs of the people. So that's basically the mission of the May Day Committee, trying to reinvoke what the 1st of May has meant and should be continued to mean. So May Day has also actually been celebrated in Australia since its inception in 1890, even if only in Queensland and the Northern Territory. Meanwhile, of course, Labor Day has become a rather arbitrary date, usually part of yet another long weekend Australia has become famous or infamous for. So be that as it may, in this 1 hour long episode of Think Again, we want to introduce listeners to a labour movement operating beyond and alongside unions and political parties, in organisations and institutions not directly associated with workers' interests, but rather with, interestingly, powerful elites in our societies and globally, namely churches. We will be having a conversation about how workers' movements and initiatives have actually historically emerged around the end of the 1890s and early 1900s, and how they are still active, in this particular case, in the Catholic Church, till today, internationally and in Australia. The three of us, Jorge, Stefan and I, we have been involved and have been influenced by the work of the Young Christian Workers, a movement, one of us, Dr. Stefan Gigac, has been a Young Christian Worker member and activist in Australia and internationally. He did his doctorate on the work of Cardinal Cardane, and I produce and pronounce Cardane in the way in which we Flemish people would actually pronounce it. Cardane was the Belgian founder of the Young Christian Workers, and Stefan has not only been very much part of the movement in Australia and internationally, but he is also the co-founder, together with me and several other people, of the movement of the Australian Cardane Institute. And then there's Jorge Jorquera, Chilean-Australian, who encountered the movement as a young man and is now active in the Victorian Socialist and in Borderlands, where he is a coordinator. And then myself, Jacques Boulier from Belgium, Flemish Belgium, I have been involved variously and internationally in Catholic movements and institutions, certainly for the first half of my life. And like my two conversation partners, I was influenced by Cardin's philosophy and activism. And in my case also, having met Cardin, actually, as a teacher during my education in university town of Leuven in Belgium. So to start our conversation, let's start with Stefan, who was at the moment for a while stuck in France thanks to the ongoing Middle East violence, and is now had just returned to Kuala Lumpur and is talking with us from Kuala Lumpur. Stefan, given your research and long-term involvement in the Young Christian Workers, I'm actually asking you to share the Cardin story with our listeners, the historical, political and institutional context in which he came to start the Young Christian Workers movement in the early 1900s, and how you came to be involved in that movement in Australia. And you've got several minutes to talk about that.
Great. Thanks, Jacques. I'll try to say a few things and not too many. Yes, as you mentioned, Joseph Cardin was a Belgian priest who eventually became a cardinal of the Catholic Church against all his own and many others people's expectations. He actually visited Australia twice in 1958 and 1966. He was born in 1882 in Brussels, which at that time was one of the most advanced industrial countries in Europe. One of the wealthiest also. In fact, people say that it was, in fact, the wealthiest country in the world at that time, the end of the 19th century. But sadly, of course, that wealth was built on the backs of workers toiling in factories in the kinds of conditions that we all know from the books of Charles Dickens, Victor Hugo and other 19th century writers. And many of those workers were young workers. We've heard of child workers from the age of 6 and 7. Fortunately, by the end of the 19th century, there were certainly not so many in Belgium at that age because of changes in the law. But there still were many young teenagers at work in those factories from the age of roughly 12 or 13. We'd still call them child workers today in the context of our world now. And Cardin grew up in an industrial town near Brussels, about 15 kilometres away, called Halle. And he used to hear those kids, young teenagers, trudging off to work in their clogs along the cobbles of the old streets there on their way to those factories where they toiled. And in the afternoon and evenings, he'd sometimes see teenage girls coming home under the influence of ether and the other industrial vapours that were emitted by the machines in those factories. He was personally deeply affected by that. And there was even one particular experience that struck him even more powerfully when he went off finally to the seminary at the age of about 14, because many of his former schoolmates had gone off to work in some of those factories. And a year later, when he came home for summer holidays, he felt alienated from him. They rejected him. They felt that he'd gone over to the side of the ruling class. In effect, they saw him as a class traitor. This was a profound shock, and in a reality, as he often said, it determined the course of his life. His father also died at a young age. He was a coal seller and died in his early 50s, probably from breathing in coal dust and things of that nature. And together, all those influences brought him to the point of deciding to devote his life to the cause of workers, and especially young workers in particular. Now, if we remember back to the end of the 19th century, many people were trying to do something about the problems of the time, and there were, in fact, many in the church also. And they got the ear of Pope Leo XIII, the current Pope's predecessor and inspiration. And he wrote a famous paper, an encyclical it was called, to the whole church, called Rerum Novarum, in which he condemned that exploitation of workers. He called for just salaries, and he recognised the right of workers to organise in trade unions. This also had a powerful impact on young Joseph, in the course that he'd take in what he was trying to do as a young priest. And he was able to implement that vision through a network that grew into a movement which took on the name, as Jacques has mentioned, of the Young Christian Workers. He was initially posted to a parish in Brussels, where there were many factories. And from the start, he tried to bring together some of those young workers. He was put in charge of projects for women, and he began to organise what he called study circles for young teenage girl workers. The idea was to train them as leaders who could take up the cause, who could take up the worker struggle on their own behalf. And pretty soon, young factory working boys also wanted to do the same thing. So to cut the long story short, by the mid-1920s, this had blossomed into a whole nationwide network or movement under the name of Young Christian Workers. As you can imagine, this also aroused a lot of opposition from those who viewed anything to do with the cause of workers as socialist or communist. And Cowdine had to battle all of those all those difficulties. But by a stroke of the Holy Spirit or Providence, he was eventually able to obtain an audience with the Pope of that time, Pope Pius XI, who, against all expectations, backed him. Some people have later compared what happened to Cowdine and Pope Pius XI to the relationship between St. Francis of Assisi and Pope Innocent, the Pope of that time. They developed a real partnership, which meant that Cowdine won the backing of the whole church. So that from 1926 onwards, people looked to the example of Belgium and began to set up young Christian workers groups in many other countries. There was even a young Australian priest there studying in Leuven, his name was Justin Simmons, became eventually an Archbishop of Melbourne. He was very inspired and impressed by what he'd seen of the YCW in Belgium. And once he was back in Australia, spent years and also as a bishop, backed the foundation and the development of the movement in Australia. So that's how the movement started, against all the odds, against it was an outlier in the Catholic Church, as Jacques mentioned. There was a lot of opposition from the conservative side of the church, and it's always faced that opposition, not just in Europe, but eventually in many other countries where it lived.
And very briefly,
so that's the background, Jack.
Yeah. And very briefly, could you say in half a minute how you became involved?
Yes, well, I was just minding my own business in a parish in St. Albans in the western suburbs of Melbourne. And I'd actually felt, like many of these young people, a bit alienated from the church. Mm-hmm. But I was invited to a youth group to talk about issues that were facing young people. And this was still the 70s. We discussed unemployment, and it was still the time of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I learned that there was a movement in the church that was interested in tackling these issues, which changed the course of my life.
Fantastic. Thanks, Stefan, for this comprehensive introduction first. And moving to Jorge, how did you become involved in, or at least influenced by, the Cardane, Young Christian Workers, and the rest of the Catholic workers' movements and ideologies?
Well, first, let me say I really enjoyed listening to Stefan and that recount of that history, and it sort of set off a few memories in my own mind. Just the name of Victor Hugo itself, it was interesting for me because I remember reading Victor Hugo when I was at university, and it being part of sort of my inspiration in some of the groups I was involved in, actually groups that I helped establish at a university level when after having come to Australia. I came to Australia from Chile, obviously, family, all of us exiled as a result of the Pinochet coup and dictatorship. And obviously, like most Latin Americans, Chileans, there was a lot of Catholic influences in our family, on both sides of our family, people involved in the Catholic Church, or certainly at least believers. And, had a big impact on me from day one. I mean, to this day, my father refers to himself as a Christian socialist. And of course, what was happening in Chile itself, where many Christians had organized in all sorts of forms, including political parties. I mean, one of the political parties that was part of the Allende government that was ousted by the dictatorship was the Izquierda Cristiana, the Christian left, which was an important part of that, the Unidad Popular government, the popular unity government of Salvador Allende. And so not surprisingly, when we were exiled here in the 70s, we were soon sort of in the arms of the Catholic Church. I mean, in many ways, the Catholic Church also was key to our settlement here in simple ways, you know, the food packages, the help with rent, putting my brothers and myself through our years, last years of school and so forth. So, you know, we had an early involvement from the get-go, having arrived here. With the Catholic Church. Also as a teenager, apart from being involved in various Catholic youth groups, Antioch, St. Vincent de Paul, including at a national level, and coming across young Christian workers through this, I also joined the Labor Party as a, I think I was about 14 when I joined the Labor Party, which back then still had some of those sort of Catholic influences, despite the DLP split from the Labor Party. So, you know, that, those influences were always there for me. And then as I continued to be active in Chilean politics in exile, and through that was working with a range of priests, actually, who were active in particular in the main organisation I had some alignment with in Chile, the Movement of the Revolutionary Left, and in fact helped with the national tour of Padre Maroto, who was part of the, actually of the armed wing, a Catholic priest who was part of the armed wing of the MIR during the dictatorship years. So that sort of involvement was just, I suppose, ever present for me. And young Christian workers in Brisbane, which is where we arrived, were, I suppose, probably particularly active, maybe I can't say comparatively at the time, but doing all sorts of activity in the West End area and so forth. So that's where I sort of had contact with that particular movement, but certainly more generally was not only influenced with, but worked alongside many of the, I suppose, radical Catholics, if you like, basically liberation theologists, and including some of the parishes.
Good. Hey, thank you. Myself, I'm from Belgium, obviously, and Belgium at that stage, certainly wall-to-wall Catholicism and floor-to-ceiling, I would add. But very importantly, that was the time of John the 23rd when I grew up, in the 50s, late 50s to early 60s. And he basically, that pope basically created a real revolution, telling us young people that we own the church, we are the church, and he really invited us in. And boy, did we really, as 17, 18, 19-year-olds, did we try to fill our churches with our own life and ideas and all of that. So there was a lot of collaboration between the young Christian workers and between the more parish-based kind of youth movements like Giro and others in Belgium. And I was part of the Giro, but there was a constant kind of an influence of the ideas of the young Christian workers, particularly when I then started to do social work in the at the School of Social Work in Leuven, a school which was run by the Catholic Workers Movement, the ACV, the Young Christian Workers and all of that. And actually, Cardain came regularly to basically do a bit of lecturing, talking about his way of doing and creating change and how he thought that the way in which young people needed to come to know their environment, their situation and all of that. And he developed that quite famous and meanwhile quite well-known formula, if you want, of doing the needed and necessary research to come to know your world, inclusive of all of the inequalities, injustices which poison it, really. And he developed that formula to see, to judge, to act. And when you listen carefully to that, to see means really to actually become part and go out where young people particularly live, see what their situation is, have an understanding of what's going on in their life, rather than just sit in your own comfortable place and sort of read about it or listen to it sort of from far away. So to see is a really important part of to participate in the life of people, young people who have been disadvantaged. And then there's the second second one, the second step, which he called to judge. And now I need to go into a little bit of linguistics, because to judge, of course, in an individualistic society which has become accustomed to don't judge me, or who has an aversion to judge mentality. It's a, in my kind of a book, a wrong translation of the original word. In Flemish, it is oordeel. That means to basically, better would be translated as to discern, to reflect. Because I still remember Cardin standing in front of us as a class and saying, oordelen, that means to judge, is not veroordelen in Flemish, which means to condemn. So really, really important to remember that he was suggesting people to reflect on what they saw, to think about it, and to connect it with whatever it is that was already available in terms of theories and stuff like that about exploitation, about disadvantage and stuff like that. And then finally, the third step, or the third part of the method, was to act, and very, very much to participate into changing what you see in front of you and what you experience. And just finally, that was really also very much a part of the time change, the changes in time more generally. In England, for example, there was the settlement movement from the late 1800s, early 1900s, which encouraged priests and students to go and live with poor people in the settlements. In Germany, there was the Protestant movement of developing what they called Indikatoren, indicators of the level of living and the quality of living people had, and they sent young people out to check. And then there was Cardin with his to see, to judge, and to act. So a really important, almost like contemporaneous kind of a movement, which was, and I know from having listened to Stefan, in France there was an entire movement as well, which was very much also opposed by much of the hierarchy. Like in Belgium, there was a priest called Daens, who also became actually a politician and was in parliament. And he was severely condemned and outed, basically, by the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. So that probably gives all of the three of us have probably come together and to give a little bit of a contextual understanding of what the movement was part of, but also what was more special about the movement. And just to let that sink in a little bit, let's have a listen to Archie Roach with Cannot Buy My Soul.
For 200 years we've been beaten down, too long on the door. My dignity I'm losing here, and mentally I'm on. There's a system here that nails us, and we're left out in the cold. Oh, they took our life and liberty, friends, but they could not buy our soul. Joe Hill died, Che Guevara fought, Palmer Roy lay down dead. If a person speaks out critically here, they could get loaded down with lead. How long can the majority wait for their story to unfold? Oh, they took their life and liberty, friends, but they could not buy their soul. Well, the clever man spoke precisely, humanity said was done. The creed for greed could not proceed if our struggles to be won. For humanity is more important here than a constant quest for gold. Ah, you may take life and liberty, friends, but you cannot buy our soul.
You're listening to Think Again on 3CR Radio, 855 AM on your dial, and streaming live at 3cr.org.au. to celebrate 1st of May, May Day, on this Friday, and running for a full hour, this Think Again program examines a workers-oriented movement located in an unexpected organizational context, the Catholic Church. With Stefan Gigac and Jorge Jorquiera, I'm having a conversation about the Young Christian Workers Movement and its founder, Cardinal Cardain. So, for this part of our conversation, let's have a look at the struggles, contradictions, and more positive, collaborative possibilities that have eventuated and that are still at work today in the overall context of workers' rights. All three of us know we have been and still are taking part in some of those debates and struggles within the church. When conservative powers saw and see anything focusing on workers' rights as socialism, communism, or otherwise godless, and in the controversies between the church and political, economic, organizational attempts to organize workers. So, Stefan, in your doctoral research, you have particularly focused on Cardinal Joseph Cardain's attempt at bringing the young workers' situation and interest to the attention of the Catholic powers that be, especially during what came to be known as the Second Vatican Council, to which I referred before, in the late 50s and early 60s. Could you share your understanding of that struggle when analyzing Cardain's role in that council based on your research and your doctoral work?
Sure, Chuck, yes. Well, actually, I'd like to hark back to a point that you made very well about the method of the Young Christian Workers Movement, the see, judge or discern act method, which was developed by the Young Christian Workers from its beginnings. That was a radical change in the whole church itself. Traditionally, the church's way of working was very much top-down. It would be priests teaching lay people, teaching them the church's doctrine and what lay people had to do. Basically, a top-down approach, telling people what they had to do. The YCW's approach completely inverted that structure. It started from the reality of the lives of those people. As you mentioned, see what's happening in their life, see what the problems are that they're experiencing were, see what the causes were, but also to judge those problems in the light of what the church taught. So, for example, I did mention Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum, in which he spoke of the dignity of the workers and the right to a just wage and the right to organise as trade unionists. So this method of the YCW helped people to judge what was happening to them, and also at their level, particularly we're talking about young teenage workers in the beginning, to take action at their own level. So this was a radical change in the church, and I think even today it still needs to be borne in mind of this method. Rather than starting from church doctrine, we need to start from the reality and the conflicts and the troubles that people experience in their everyday life and assist them and work with them to tackle those problems. And the second thing was that, as I mentioned, the YCW spread very quickly in the time of Pope Pius XI. It reached 50 countries by World War II and 100 by the 1960s. And it also spawned a series of similar movements, including in Australia, the Young Christian Students Movement. In most cases, it was young priests who founded those movements in the various countries from the 1920s on. And by the 1960s, many of them had become leaders of their churches. Some of them had become famous theologians or sociologists, but also many bishops. And at that Second Vatican Council, out of 2,500-odd bishops, 250 of them had been formed or worked as chaplains or helping the movement in various ways. One-tenth of the participants at the Second Vatican Council had direct personal experience. So they brought that method into the Second Vatican Council, into the actual structure of its deliberations. There's a famous document from the council called Gaudium et Spes on the church's role in the world of today. And it's totally drafted using that see, judge and act framework. which after the council became the model for so many other Catholic organisations around the world. In Australia, Vinnie's uses it. Many people would know of Caritas Australia, Caritas International. They follow the Sea Judge Act. So in this way, the YCW and Cardeen have had a huge impact on the church over the course of the 20th and into the 21st century.
But you also have written about some of the problems they encountered with getting that message in, with Cardeen being a cardinal meanwhile and being part of that concilium. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
I could. Well,
for a couple of minutes.
He faced opposition. Yeah, a couple. I could go on for a long time about that. I happened to be working in the Vatican archives. I mean, February for a month there, and I was looking at the documents and the relationship between Cardeen and the Vatican. I mentioned that he had a very good relationship with Pope Pius XI, but you can see in the archives that there were many, many functionaries in the Holy See who are opposed to his method. And one of them in particular was criticizing Cardeen's idea of lay people as apostles. Because on the one hand, who are the apostles? They were the successors of Jesus's apostles. It was only bishops who could be apostles. So this is one of the oppositions to it. And the second critique made of it by one of those Vatican cardinals was that Cardeen was Protestantizing the church. He was putting lay people in the forefront and, in effect, what they thought, downplaying the role of the priests. So these are the kind of theological conflicts that Cardeen had to deal with. And, yeah, there's some amazing stories about the way, and you can learn a lot about lobbying and influencing from studying the way he approached it. But the big thing was that since the movement became one of the first international movements, they had developed an international movement from the late 1940s at a time when very few people could travel. So by the time the Vatican Council came around in the 60s, those 250 bishops, they already knew each other. Not all of them knowing each other, but they had good networks among each other. So they were able to have a profound influence at the council that went well beyond their numbers in the council.
Yeah.
I could go on a lot longer, Jack.
I know. Yes. You did an entire PhD about it, as well as many, many other writings. Yeah. So thanks. Let's move to Jorge, the story of the Latin American Catholic Church and its struggles internally and externally has not really become well known in Australia, as far as I know, nor elsewhere. Could you give listeners a little bit of an idea of what was and is at stake there?
Oh, look, for sure, Joe. I mean, briefly speaking, I suppose you could, I think you could fairly make the case that it's from Latin America that the heart and soul of liberation theology beats, or certainly originated. And for me personally, one of the most influential texts I read, you know, in my youth, I don't know, I think I was about 12, 13 when I read Gustavo Gutierrez's Theology of Liberation. And to this day, I think that remains, you know, really the pivotal text in terms of liberation theology and the whole option for the poor, you know, which was, I suppose, the anchor point of liberation theology. But, of course, it was much more than theory or theology. I mean, it was something that was practiced in Latin America in very real ways. And certainly in terms of my own personal history, I mean, it was very much part of our family growing up. I mean, probably two or three of our brothers are named after some famous or another revolutionary priests, most notably Camilo Torres, for example, the revolutionary priest in Colombia who joined one of the many guerrilla organizations during the sort of various periods of dictatorship there in Colombia. And on a sort of a more sort of maybe, for want of a better word, beautiful sort of level, the work of Father Cardenal in Nicaragua, you know, really stands out as a liberation theologist, a fighter for the poor and the working classes, and an artist in so many ways. You know, his poetry still rings very true in terms of the aspirations of Latin American masses. And despite, you know, what happened in Nicaragua after 1989, you know, his influence, I think, culturally remains not only in Nicaragua, but throughout the continent. And, of course, there's many other priests and theologians, including very important theologically, philosophically for the Catholic Church, people like Boff and Helder Camara, you know, in both from Brazil and many movements in Brazil. And not unimportantly, I mean, this was recognized even by the sort of the empire, if you like. I mean, there were very, very concrete efforts funded by the State Department in the US to counter that influence of the Catholic Church in Latin America in its heyday of the 60s and 70s, including funding various evangelical movements that had otherwise not had any influence in the continent, but were given large sums of money to, you know, to try to break away sections of the Christian community from the Catholic Church, and in particular from those rank and file sections of the Catholic Church that had started to organize priests and lay people around the ideas and the practice of liberation theology.
And particularly also the way in which then, as you said, the more evangelical branch started to also supported by the West, basically, broadly speaking, and the churches in the West. You, any kind of examples of that in Chile itself?
Or? Well, it was definitely true, very obviously true in Brazil. I mean, you know, in Brazil, the funding of those evangelical movements and their quite important role in quite not just right-wing but even far-right ideas. I mean, you even see it in presidencies like Bolsonaro's. You know, those far right, very sort of Trumpite-like, if you like, Christian movements. You know, the same sort of Christian far right Christian movements that you're seeing now, being sort of part of the Trump establishment, if you like. I mean, they had been rehearsed much earlier, decades earlier, especially in Brazil. Probably that was the country in which they were most influential, including in sort of upper echelons of politics. But they also played a role in Argentina. They played, you know, similarly negative roles, counter, if you like, revolutionary roles in throughout the continent, in Peru. Those were the cases in which they were most evident, that sort of evangelical right-wing movements.
I remember Paulo Freire when he was here, and I met him several times. He certainly saw that as very much part of the reasons why he had to leave Brazil, or was basically forced to leave Brazil as well. So there's quite some confirmation there from Paulo Freire, one of the people we probably well known across all of our social movement activities and organizations. So thanks, Jorge. I like to add my own experiences and of these tensions and the struggles as I slowly have moved out of the Catholic Church and working with in collaboration with Catholic Church efforts. So still acknowledging, though, my debt to the Church as an institution and to others also working for social change within that context. So in the last phases of the concilium, which Stefan was referring to, already quite some organized resistance had started to happen. And the next pope, Paul VI, he certainly already started I'm not sure what to call it, breaking a little bit into that positive movement which was created by the organization of the within the Catholic Church. And by the next one, or the overnext one, John Paul II, that really became a very clear strategy, particularly also influenced by Cardinal Ratzinger. The German Cardinal Ratzinger was living in Germany for 10 years after I'd spent 3 years in Congo, particularly again also collaborating with young Christian workers and the Catholic workers' movement there. But the mid-70s were really a turning point, particularly also in Germany, when Ratzinger, the Cardinal, became more and more powerful and became as well the Inquisition chief in the Catholic Church, and that was very clearly visible with some of the work I did. I then meanwhile had become a lecturer in schools of social work and universities in Germany, and continued to work with some of the progressive youth movements there, particularly the Catholic student movement. And one incident, for example, we had organized a tremendous national meeting of young people, 4,000 young people who had met in Aachen in Aix-la-Chapelle for a whole week talking about the role of young people in the church. And it was fantastic. It was really in the kind of tradition of project studies, with kids, young people, adolescents and young adults, starting to think, what is it that our role is in society? And developing also activist kinds of ways of living, basically. And at the end of that conference, Ratzinger intervened, who Ratzinger at that stage was responsible for youth work in the Catholic branch. And so he basically sacked the entire board, as well as all of the paid labor in that movement. And that kind of thing got me really into thinking whether my continuing and ongoing ways of working with the institutional church was really the way to go. And I very slowly, particularly also through other engagements in activism and in teaching, slowly moved away from the institution and the kinds of things I had learned from basically from the time when I was born. And so it was really also a sad kind of a thing, because as you do that kind of work within an organization, you make friends, you become acquainted, and you feel how moving out of it then also starts damaging the relationships you have been creating and you have been nurturing for so long. So I initially was thinking to have a little bit of a music break, but I think we're talking that well. We have just over a quarter of an hour less. For listeners, you're listening to Think Again on 3CR, a special program celebrating May Day, the 1st of May, traditionally the international celebration of labor and workers. So let's spend our last 15 minutes or so to have a think about what this whole involvement has really done to us, to our lives, and how it has changed it and how it still reverberates in what we do. And Stefan, to start with you again, you have been involved as an activist, as well as having studied and researched the Young Christian Workers Movement and its founder, Cardin. What are your main learnings from this involvement, and what keeps you going at it?
Oh, yes, big questions, Jack. Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd just like to say it's great to hear both of you saying the things that you have. It's because there's so many points of contact between experiences that I've had and names that you've both mentioned that have been big influences on my own life. And basically, what the YCW did was joined those influences, or joined me to those influences, brought me together with those influences, because, yeah, I was just a young guy in Melbourne, struggling at university and wondering why I was even studying law. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of being recruited to the YCW that gave me a direction in my life, as seeing that, wow, you know, we really can do something to change things. And so that's how I got involved in the Western suburbs back in those days, lots of youth unemployment. And we organised, I saw some problems among young people, and I'm sure both of you have seen it even more. But it really brought me face to face with those kinds of issues. But also working with those people, you know, helping them to find a method with which to tackle those problems themselves. So that's become, you know, a whole part of the rest of my life. Then when I worked for the YCW in Asia, in effect, it was like living in real time what Cardine had lived 70 or 80 years before, because like, for example, Thailand and the Philippines in the 70s and 80s and Korea were going through the Industrial Revolution. And it was a very similar phenomenon. I met young women. I still know some of them she was young then. She was 16, starting a trade union. She was in the YCW, not even Christian, but Buddhist. They even criticized her for being part of a Christian movement because she was trying to organize the young workers in a factory. Sexually harassed, terrible things that were done to those young women that were struggling for the rights of workers in Thailand. And it really, you know, had a huge impact on me just being friends with those people and seeing the struggles that they were living. And Jorge mentioned Latin America and the people that died there and were killed. And there was a guy called Pepe Palacio from Argentina, who disappeared in December 1975. Of course, disappeared meant dropped out of a helicopter or something like that. And he was a YCW leader. He was the first international lay chaplain of the movement. And within months of being appointed, this is his fate. And I met his son many years later. And his son actually told me that, you know, 25 years later, he'd researched it and was able to confirm that he'd been killed as part of that American-sponsored project. Which bird was it? I mean, Vietnam, it was Phoenix in Latin America. What was it, Jorge, that assassination program?
I can't remember, but I know what you're talking about.
Condor. Condor, exactly. That's the one. Yeah, it was a campaign to eliminate community leaders, trade union leaders, anybody that could have influence, and he was one of them. So I didn't know him personally, but I know his son now and his granddaughter as well. So you know, you see, kind of, and you feel part of it, and so many things like that changed the direction of my life. I'll just tell you one more short, small story. Maybe you knew Francois Houtart from Belgium. Jacques, mm-hmm. I remember one story he told me. He was in Havana with the YCW before the revolution, and they had to meet the archbishop or the cardinal in the huge Episcopal palace, which it literally was, and they were walking through the corridor past the hairdresser and past all these other things, and Cardine was deeply shocked, and he was muttering to Francois, you know, these people don't know what's coming to them, you know, mm-hmm. and in fact, of course, what came a year later, within 12 or 18 months, was the revolution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is who Cardine was, just revolted by a church allied with the rich mm-hmm. and working for a church of the poor. And so that's kind of, mm-hmm. you could say, the light that I try to follow.
Mm. Could you just for 1 minute or so talk about the Australian Cardine Institute, which we together started a couple of years ago now?
Yes. Being a youth movement and especially a young workers movement, I mean, the first decades, people didn't go on to university. Even in Australia, I was one of the earliest of the YCW leaders who actually had a university education. But the outcome was that documentation was always very poor, and the production of training resources and things like that. Mm-hmm. So the Australian Cardine Institute is an effort to try to kind of assist or provide some of those resources to the leaders, to the young people of today.
Mm-hmm. And we'll put all the references and so on our program page. Jorge, what about you as a socialist and an activist being inspired by other Latin American examples of revolution and social change? What keeps you going, and what part played your time in the Catholic Church in all of this?
It might seem quaint, but I think a word that reverberates, certainly should reverberate for all Christians, is a word that has always stood central in my values. From a quote, not from a Christian, but from Ernesto Che Guevara, you know, one of the, I suppose, the most iconic revolutionaries of Latin America, who once said, to paraphrase, you know, it might sound ridiculous, but the most important quality of a revolutionary is to be able to love. And, you know, it's obviously very easy and I think necessary, sadly increasingly necessary in the world we live, to be able to hate, because I think you have to hate the hate. You have to hate the hate. I think that's an important motivator. You have to hate the horrible things that are being done by horrible people. But if that isn't anchored in, you know, a much deeper sense of love, which is very much, you know, something that was always central to liberation theology, then we lose all perspective about possible change. So for me, I suppose, you know, that's something that's been a consistent, despite having moved practically away from the Catholic Church. And it was always a tense relationship because, you know, it's funny, I mentioned at the beginning of the program that my father to this day calls himself a Christian socialist, but if you give him another cup of wine, he'll also tell you why he doesn't attend Mass or go to church. And he'll often come back to the same story, which, again, I'll probably die remembering, which is a story about my grandfather in a little country town out of Santiago called Constitución. My grandfather was a bit of a sort of a public figure in the town, and he was approached one day, this would have been back in the 50s, by a peasant family nearby the town asking him to help get their child who was dying baptized. Because the priest wouldn't baptize him, and my grandfather went back to the church, there was only one church in the town at the time, to ask that the priest baptize this kid, and the priest wouldn't baptize him because the family couldn't pay the necessary fee for the baptism. And my grandfather basically invited the priest outside the church because he said he wouldn't punch him there, but he would do it outside of the church. And that story in many ways, you know, still sticks with me. And that sort of is probably, you know, that contradictory relationship with the institutions of the church. But that said, you know, that heart of liberation theology, that, you know, focus on love, I think is probably more important now because there will be a lot more hate. There is necessarily going to be a lot more hate growing. It is growing in the world. So being anchored in that love, I think, is it something that, you know, I appreciate as part of that background in my life history. Mm.
That's a really good, thanks, Jorge. That's a really good entry point for my own learning. So for me, the shift through both the experience with Gardein and the learning in the School of Social Work in the early 60s, because that's when I graduated, was very, very much almost like at the bottom of the rest of my learning throughout my life in Congo, then in Germany, activism, and also particularly through my doctoral studies in the United States and in my teaching here, and particularly also at the basis of us starting the Borderlands Cooperative. So it is really the idea that the focus on relationality, that we as humans, as a species, are actually by necessity a relational species, rather than that focus on the individual and the self as the only agency defining where we go, what route we take, how we need to live in life and all of that. That individualism kind of focus and almost like, I don't know what to call it, it's almost like an obligation to first think about yourself and then about the rest. And so really that has been for me part of the learning out of the working with and in the church as a young adolescent in the youth movement, and then particularly also in my education towards social work, particularly also as a researcher, really, it has changed me a lot. Because you think about the see, judge, act, or the see, what I call reflect, act kind of way, that is pretty much the same kind of a process and the same kind of attitudes which we promote in action research and in participatory action research, and particularly therefore also in all the social change proposals and activism we try to instigate and be part of. Seeing means really you need to be part of what you are involved in, what you want to change, rather than just sit in your little laboratory or in your office and think that writing an article is going to do the job for you. Writing articles is an important part, but it really only is becoming important when it sits on top of lived experience, as we now call it. Then the judging part or the discernment part really puts the theory and the practice, or as we like to call it, praxis, together. And we actually are always thinking when we do things, and we are always translating whatever we think into possible action. That certainly was the philosophy behind the see, judge, act kind of philosophy, ideology, which was imbued in us as young people and gradually as we grow into adolescence and responsible adulthood. And then act rather than just look at it, diagnose it, and then sit and see what happens. You've got to be part with what you in what you believe in. And you've got to be part in trying out what it is that you want to change, and so that you yourself also experience what the change really experientially means, whether it makes any sense at all. So for me, that really was a parallelism which I experienced both in the church, as part of that, part of the church, throughout my education and my becoming a researcher, and then particularly also for the last 28 years into the starting of the Borderlands Cooperative and also the New Community Journal, that that is the kind of philosophy and ideology which saturates all the reasons why it is that we are doing these things. So that's my story. Thank you, Jorge. Thank you, Stefan, for being part of this conversation and for, you know, our reflection, really, our joint reflection as to what it all means and how the kinds of animosities which we sometimes have been part of, but you know, against all the workers' movements, like the church-based ones, the lay-based movements and all of that, actually they all should be seen as working towards the same liberatory kind of ideology we all really try to nurture further and make part of our reason for being, and now particularly also adding our ways of dealing with nature. Relationality also should be spreading onto the way in which we deal with that which keeps us alive, and that is our ecology, that is our way of living, and that is our, you know, that we nurture, that as a species we are basically meant to nurture. So thank you again, and we will soon now be listening to the next program in this Labor Day long program at 3CR. So thanks for listening to Think Again on 3CR Community Radio. If you want to send us any comments about today's program, you can email Borderlands, borders@borderlands.org.au. And remember, our past programs are available by podcast on a variety of platforms and via the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. So thanks again, Jorge. Thanks again, Stefan. To bring us into Black and Deadly, presented by Duran, Bunjilini, Robbie Thorpe and Svi Belling, please enjoy Milky Mana by King Stingray.
you've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.